get into territory that I want to read, I might read a little bit of the paper that I've brought along. So the thesis of the paper is that when you have a marketplace of ideas, which is an idea, I want to clarify, only functions properly when there's intellectual trust among its participants. So this is a claim both, I suppose, in the theory of the marketplace of ideas, but also a claim about intellectual trust, applying that more epistemological notion to something that maybe more properly belongs in political philosophy. And the plan for the talk will just be three rough sections. So I first want to talk about marketplaces and what I think their function is, and in particular to articulate this liberal idea of a marketplace of ideas. Secondly, I want to talk about intellectual trust and what it is in this context. And finally, I want to talk about a problem for the liberal defense of the establishment of a marketplace of ideas, which is the problem of offensive speech. And I think my thesis will give us some insight and some and a new kind of strategy for addressing that problem. So here's the liberal argument that I have in mind. So I think a certain kind of liberal, this is a traditional utilitarian liberal who sees the establishment of various freedoms as beneficial. This kind of liberal argument is to be contrasted with the kind of argument offered by those who defend various sorts of freedoms as natural rights. This in American politics, that kind of view is sometimes known as libertarianism. If you want to think about the history of philosophy, Locke holds the natural rights type view, and there's no implication that the establishment of the freedoms that he's describing would have any good consequences. Whereas Mill is a liberal of the tradition, what I'm calling the traditional utilitarian sort. For Mill, the establishment of various forms of freedom is grounded in the fact that doing so would be beneficial. So this liberal argument is one that comes out of that Millian tradition, not the Lockean tradition. And the idea is that just as the function of a marketplace is to create an incentive for producers of goods to sell desirable goods, the function of a marketplace of ideas is to create an incentive for the people who participate in the marketplace to articulate and defend plausible ideas. So I think this is what people are talking about when they talk about a marketplace of ideas, or at least that's what I'm going to be talking about when I talk about a marketplace of ideas. So let me try to flesh out this argument a little bit more. And I don't think it's going to matter whether we think of the marketplace of ideas as an analogy or metaphor. So you might think it's not really a marketplace, it's just a metaphor. Or maybe in some broader sense of marketplace, a marketplace of ideas is a marketplace. But in either sense, we can focus first on the case of a more literal marketplace in which goods are bought and sold, and then we'll move over to the case of a marketplace of ideas. And what the liberal wants to do with this argument is first make a point, or maybe just make an assumption about marketplaces, literal marketplaces of goods that are bought and sold, and then carry over a certain structural analogy to the case of marketplaces of ideas. So the liberal assumes something about marketplaces, which is that it's beneficial to establish them. And the reason that it is said to be beneficial to establish them is that when there is competition between the producers for the custom of the consumers, this creates an incentive for the producers to sell desirable goods. This incentive is often described in terms of market pressure or market forces. These operate on the producers, giving them an incentive or motive to improve the desirability of the stuff that they are offering in the marketplace. The establishment of a liberal marketplace in this sense requires the establishment of a principle of free trade, which involves two kinds of freedom. First, the freedom of producers to sell what they want to whomever they want, and secondly, the freedom of consumers to buy what they want from whomever they want. And the idea is that a marketplace will not create any incentive for producers to sell more desirable goods unless these two forms of freedom are, at least to a certain degree, established. And the reason for that is that unless these two forms of freedom are to a certain degree established, there will simply be no competition between the producers for the custom of the consumers, and thus the market forces or market pressures will not be created. Again, it's important to contrast this approach to free trade with the non-utilitarian natural rights type approach to free trade, on which the freedom to sell and buy is a natural right enjoyed by all human beings. Locke, you know, might say something like that. You mingle your labor with something out in the woods, and then it becomes yours to sell. The kind of liberal argument I'm developing here doesn't appeal to anything like that. It's the benefits of establishing free trade that justify its establishment. So that has some important consequences that maybe we could talk about in Q&A if people want to talk about the difference between this kind of liberal argument and this kind of liberal defense of free trade, a utilitarian liberal defense of free trade, and the what's known as a libertarian or natural rights approach to free trade. So that's the liberal assumption about marketplaces. And the argument I want to focus on is one that it takes that idea and says it can be applied in the realm of ideas or in the intellectual realm. So in the place of producers of goods, we imagine articulators and defenders of ideas, those that in some probably metaphorical sense, maybe not metaphorical sense, they produce the ideas, right? They bring them out and they, in what is probably a metaphorical sense, they sell those ideas. They put them up for sale. But the thought is that a marketplace of ideas will involve competition between those who articulate and defend ideas for now not the purchase of those ideas, although that can happen in some cases, right? But just the acceptance of those ideas by buyers, or in this case, sort of anyone else who is participating in the marketplace. In the same way that competition in the case of a more literal marketplace requires some form of free trade, competition in a marketplace of ideas requires two analogous forms of freedom, analogous to the freedom to buy and the freedom to sell I mentioned a moment ago. So on the one hand, the establishment of a marketplace of ideas requires the establishment of freedom of expression, which is to say the freedom to articulate and defend whatever ideas one wants to articulate and defend, and secondly, a principle of liberty of conscience should be established, needs to be established at least to some degree, and that's the freedom to accept whatever ideas one wants to accept. So those two forms of freedom correspond to the two forms of freedom we were talking about in the case of a more literal marketplace. And again, we can contrast this utilitarian liberal argument with a natural rights view on which the liberty of conscience or freedom of expression are grounded in natural rights. The thought is that there is a benefit to establishing a marketplace of ideas. It has good consequences, just like there's a benefit to establishing a marketplace. Well, what is the benefit exactly? Well, the thought is that just as in the case of a literal marketplace of goods, there is an incentive created for producers to sell more desirable goods. In the case of a marketplace of ideas, there is an incentive for those who articulate and defend ideas to articulate and defend plausible or more plausible ideas. So let me ground this a little bit in Mill. So here's how Mill describes the traditional liberal defense of free trade in On Liberty. He says it's now recognized, though not till after a long struggle, that both the cheapness and the good quality of commodities are most effectually provided for by leaving the producers and sellers perfectly free under the sole check of equal freedom to the buyers for supplying themselves elsewhere. And Mill famously, more famously indeed than that brief and sort of passing defense of free trade, Mill famously defends the principles of liberty of conscience and freedom of expression by appeal to a utilitarian argument that establishing a marketplace of ideas, although he doesn't use that expression, will improve the quality of the ideas that are being articulated and defended in the marketplace. And in one particularly influential and striking passage, he says this: unless an opinion is suffered to be and actually is vigorously and earnestly contested, it will, by most of those who receive it, be held in the manner of a prejudice, with little comprehension or feeling of its rational grounds. So the idea is that only in the context of free and open discussion can we expect reasons for an opinion to be provided, and the provision of those reasons improves the quality of the opinion. It makes it, transforms it from a mere prejudice into a reasonable opinion, at least can, if all goes well. So the articulation and defense of an idea in a critical space of reasons, what Mill described as a vigorous and earnest contest between an idea and its alternatives. Sorry, there's some update. My computer's trying to update itself. It's only in that kind of context are we going to get this benefit coming out. So we have a utilitarian defense of a marketplace of ideas. Okay. Now, there are two basic, there may be more equally important problems with this argument, but two very basic problems I want to identify. One is called the problem of irrationality, and the other called the problem of offensive speech. Short story is, I have very little to say here about the problem of irrationality, and it's something we could talk about in Q&A if people want to talk about it. The problem arises from a fact about marketplaces, which is that the thing that marketplaces are said to bring about through the exertion of market forces or market pressures is desirability, but the nature of desirability is determined entirely by the preferences of the consumers. So if the consumers want something nasty or awful, that's what the market is going to tend to deliver. So you might think, in the case of marketplaces of ideas, if the participants, the ones who are accepting the ideas in the marketplace, are too irrational, they will go after ideas that are not of a higher quality, and there will be market pressures towards ideas not that are of a higher quality, but that are of a low quality, because that's what the consumers of ideas prefer. So think about vulgarity, sensationalism, ideas that just reinforce one's existing prejudices. You might think, when you establish a marketplace of ideas, it's ideas like that that you get more of, not ideas that are, as Mill seems to think, reasonable or more likely to be true. So that, I think, is a quite serious problem. I think there's a lot to be said about that, including whether it's the worry about the irrationality of the participants is overblown. And it's very much an empirical question about the irrationality of actual people, I think, that generates that problem. So we can talk about that a little bit more. I'm going to set that aside. The problem I want to focus on here is this problem of offensive speech, which is that the problem flows from the fact that when you establish a principle of freedom of expression, you can almost inevitably expect that people will say offensive things. And offensive here, I'm using this in a somewhat unusual way, I just mean speech that causes offense. So there's obviously another sense of the word offensive, where something is offensive when it warrants offense. Something can cause offense without being offensive in that more normatively loaded sense of the word offense. But I am using offensive in a very broad and non-normative sense, where something is offensive only if and only if it causes offense to someone. That, I think, is a problem for the liberal, because offensive speech, even in this broad sense, is harmful. Now, you might think of the idea associated with Mill, right, that a speech is never harmful. Harm, Mill seems to think, is something bodily or physical, and physical in a way that speech is not physical. But this, I think, is a bit of a verbal dispute. Offensive speech is hurtful, it causes distress, it causes anxiety, and it actually comes with it a host of harms or wrongs or bad things. And all those bad things, you might think, outweigh the various benefits. So even if I'm right that establishing a marketplace of ideas has various benefits, like that it creates these market pressures towards plausibility, you might think all those benefits are outweighed by the harm of offensive speech. This is both a theoretical problem and a practical problem, because opposition to the principle of freedom of expression is quite common and in some places on the rise, in other places not. So liberals are under a lot of pressure here to respond to this, both as a matter of theory, but also as a matter of practice. Now, probably the most familiar option here for the liberal is to go in for some kind of censorship. And that's not incompatible with the liberal argument I presented, because, of course, the liberal argument I presented is a utilitarian argument. So if there's a case where establishing a freedom of expression isn't beneficial, then don't establish it, the utilitarian liberal says. So there's no incompatibility between censorship and the kind of liberalism I'm imagining. And that is indeed the option that I think many, many liberals take when it comes to certain kinds of offensive speech, such as hate speech, is they would argue for some form of censorship, or at least some form of social sanction. So what I want to do here is, by thinking a little bit about intellectual trust and the way intellectual trust functions to promote the proper functioning of a marketplace of ideas, I think we can approach offensive speech from a slightly different angle, and we get a slightly sort of richer picture of how liberals might go about dealing with this problem of offensive speech. So my thesis about intellectual trust is, I think, motivated by and can be illustrated by a point about marketplaces in general, or marketplaces of goods, which is that marketplaces, to function properly in the way that I've said they function, namely to produce the kinds of market forces or market pressures that they are meant to produce, according to the liberal, they require among their participants a certain kind of mutual trust, which I want to call commercial trust. So let me say a little bit about that. I am assuming here something that is, I think, not uncontroversial, but also fairly common in the literature on trust, which is that trust is a positive attitude towards both the competence of another person and towards their goodwill, where their competence is something like their ability to do a certain thing, and their goodwill is understood as their motivation or disposition to exercise that competence when needed by you, when you call upon them to do so. So to trust someone is to have some kind of positive attitude. Belief would be a simple kind of theory. Many people opt for something less than belief, such as hope or optimism, but some kind of positive attitude towards the competence and goodwill of the other person. That's what trust amounts to on this kind of common approach, or common family of approaches, where the various more schematic bits of this could be filled in as any particular views. So if this is right, then we can distinguish various different kinds of trust by characterizing various different competences towards which those different kinds of trust are directed. So commercial trust, as I'm understanding it, is something like a positive attitude towards the ability to be fair in commercial dealings. And I think what I want to say is that when you think about how a marketplace would have to work in the way that liberals think it works, the participants would have to trust one another, at least in some minimal threshold, in this way, namely vis-a-vis their ability or competence to be fair. I have a couple kinds of fairness in mind. The example I use throughout the paper is that of a set of bakeries that are selling bread and a bunch of people who are buying the bread from the bakeries. So the traditional liberal argument is that if you've got a couple of, you know, two or three or four bakeries and they're competing for the custom of the customers, they're going to have this motive to create better bread, make it cheaper, and make it more desirable in all kinds of ways. So one thing I think would have to be the case if any of that were true is that the customers would have to trust the bakeries to offer them something that was bread and not some mock-up that ends up not being bread at all. When you get it home and unwrap it, it looks sort of like a bread, but it's not a bread at all. The marketplace could not function if that were going on. The marketplace could not function if too many of the customers were using counterfeit notes to buy the bread. So you need a certain degree of trust in the basic kinds of promise-keeping that are constitutive of commercial exchange. I think you also need something, and this relates a bit more to what I want to say about marketplaces of ideas, but you also need something like trust in the fairness of the other participants to not be overly prejudiced. So, for example, if there are three bakeries, the Catholic, Protestant, and Muslim bakeries, and the only people who shop there are the Catholic, Protestant, and Muslim customers, you're not going to get the kind of competition that you get in the previous situation, right? I mean, maybe that's the best way for things to be, but you're not going to get market pressures in that kind of situation pushing people towards producing better bread. Maybe something else will be causing people to produce high quality bread, but you're not going to get a market kind of force in that kind of case. So people need to trust each other that they're not going to be too prejudiced for the marketplace to function properly. And I lump all that under the heading of commercial trust, which involves at least trust in the competence of others to be fair at a basic level in their commercial dealings. So the thesis of my paper is that in the same way that the proper functioning of a marketplace of goods requires commercial trust among its participants, the proper functioning of a marketplace of ideas requires intellectual trust among its participants. So what is intellectual trust in the relevant sense? You may be familiar with an account of intellectual trust that you find in Richard Foley and Linda Zagzebski's work, and I think in others as well, where intellectual trust, the competence at which intellectual trust is directed is reliability, tendency to believe truths and to avoid believing falsehoods. Long story short, that conception of intellectual trust is not, sort of in the first instance anyway, not the notion of intellectual trust I think we need here in connection with the thesis that I'd like to defend. So when I talk about intellectual trust, I am at least talking about a broader competence, an attitude directed at a much broader kind of competence, and perhaps even a distinct kind of competence, which I want to call critical competence, or perhaps dialectical competence is an equally good name. And it's a complex ability that comprises an ability to listen, an ability to take other people's ideas seriously, an ability to follow arguments where they lead, an ability to criticize others when required and to ask them good questions, an ability to be open and to be sincere in one's critical engagement with others, and an ability to refrain from insulting, stigmatizing, and silencing those with whom you disagree. Parts of this complexibility, maybe large parts of it, are sometimes described in virtue epistemology as forms of open-mindedness, and I think that's a nice phrase. In Rawls's work, you get occasional appeals to the virtue of fair-mindedness, which is said to be an important part of the space of public reason. So I'm very much in agreement with people who praise open-mindedness and fair-mindedness here. And the thought here is that a positive attitude towards the critical competence of other people, and the mutual existence of such positive attitudes is a precondition for the proper functioning of a marketplace of ideas. Two cases to illustrate this, if it isn't sort of sounding plausible already. One is that when a speaker is overly dogmatic, when they come across as And I mean a speaker here just as in someone who says something, someone who articulates and defends an idea. When a speaker is dogmatic, there is very little motive or incentive to criticizing them because there's very little chance that they'll change their mind. So when someone presents themselves as sort of refusing to change their mind or disposed never to change their mind no matter what, come what may, this very much diminishes the incentive of others to critically engage with them, and that's going to diminish the kind of generation of market forces in the marketplace of ideas that we've been describing. So if you like, that's a kind of supply side. If we're continuing with the economic analogy here, that's a kind of supply side problem that you've got insufficient critical competence on the supply side of the marketplace of ideas. It's a bit like a bread baker who says, "I will never change the recipe, no matter how nasty it tastes." On the demand side of the equation, I think we also can see why certain failures of critical competence and thus failures of intellectual trust are going to create problems. So if you think of those who are in the marketplace of ideas as potential acceptors of ideas, think of the ways in which prejudice undermines the kind of functioning I'm trying to describe here. If I'm considering articulating some view with the hope of getting it accepted by all of you, and I find out that all of you are sort of prejudicially disposed to ignore and not take seriously what I say, perhaps because of some social identity category that I happen to fall into, that's going to diminish any incentive I might have to come out with a high quality articulation or defense of this idea. I'm not going to have the same kind of motive. Again, it's analogous to the case of a baker who finds out that no one shops at their shop because they don't like their religion or they don't like what sect they belong to or whatever. So we need, for a marketplace of ideas to function, people need to be able to trust each other to be, again, fair in certain basic ways. Fairness here now in an intellectual way. We need to be able to trust one another to be critically competent, at least at some minimal level, for there to be the kind of market pressures that are said to occur in a marketplace of ideas to occur. Okay, that was all a bit quick, but I want to wrap up so we can talk about this a little bit. So let me turn now back to the problem of offensive speech, assuming for the time being that thesis that the proper functioning of a marketplace of ideas requires mutual intellectual trust among its participants. So offensive speech, I think, is harmful in many ways, again, in this broad sense of harm, where that does not merely mean bodily, or in this case, I don't think it probably even means bodily or physical harm, although I think those notions are themselves a little bit obscure. I think offensive speech is harmful because it's painful to be offended. Offense is at least typically, it's typically or often painful to be offended, and that's bad. That's a bad thing. Pain is a bad thing, at least according to these utilitarian liberals that I'm articulating, the utilitarian liberalism that I'm trying to articulate here. Another kind of harm of offensive speech is that offensive speech, I think, is often insulting, demeaning, degrading, or derogatory. And those are all harms, again, in a broad sense, which should be taken into the account by the kind of utilitarian or at least consequentialist liberal that I'm trying to get a grip on their view here. However, there's one particular kind of harm that I want to focus on here because it relates specifically to the proper functioning of marketplaces of ideas. And that is the harm that can accrue when a person, or more importantly, a group of people, is systematically offended by speech that is produced in a would-be marketplace of ideas, and thereby excluded from participation in that marketplace. Now, how can someone be excluded from the marketplace of ideas simply by being offended? Well, I think the reason for this is something psychological. It's that it's very hard to engage with that which offends us. It's simply takes a lot of effort and motivation to do so. Offense, I said before, is painful, at least typically, at least often. To engage with that which offends us is, I think, sometimes an incredibly hard thing to do. It's like what's disgusting. Just as we very naturally recoil from what disgusts us and want to turn away, we very naturally recoil from what offends us and want to turn away from it. And you, I think we have, we're familiar with this, turning off the radio or the television when that incredibly offensive politician comes on the screen or over the airwaves. It takes a lot to sit there and even just to listen, much less to critically engage, right? So I think it's very easy for someone to be excluded from a marketplace of ideas because they just can't take it. They just can't take it anymore. And when this happens to a group of people, and in particular when this happens to a group of people who are united by some shared social identity category, I think then we have a problem vis-a-vis the proper functioning of a marketplace of ideas, because the whole point of a marketplace of ideas is that you're going to have lots of different people coming in with lots of different perspectives, lots of, this is relates obviously to Natalie Ashton's talk yesterday. You're going to have lots of different perspectives coming from lots of different directions. And unless all those perspectives can be given a fair hearing in the marketplace, it will not function as well as it otherwise would. It would be analogous to the exclusion of certain, you know, certain bakeries are shut down and not allowed to sell their bread. Now, you want more competition in a marketplace to create more pressure towards desirable goods. Well, you want more competition in a marketplace of ideas to create more pressure towards plausible ideas. So the exclusion of individuals, and in particular the exclusions of groups who are united by social identity, is a huge problem, I think, for marketplaces of ideas. And that's a harm. And that's the harm, I think, can be partly mitigated by intellectual trust. So I want to talk about that. So what I claim is that intellectual trust makes offensive speech easier to deal with. And in that respect, when there is an environment or a context of mutual intellectual trust, it is possible for offended parties to participate in a marketplace of ideas that they would otherwise be unable to participate in. I think there's three contexts where this happens. I only want to talk about one very briefly right now, which is the case of political protests that are offensive. I also think that there are cases of offensive pedagogy that are really worth thinking about here, and cases of offensive journalism that are worth thinking about here. These are three, at least three specific contexts in which intellectual trust can make offensive speech easier to deal with and thereby mitigate at least one of the harms of offensive speech. So I might turn to my text here. So consider first these white supremacists who you may have, if my discussion so far with all its million capitalism hasn't seemed American enough, it's now going to seem even more American because the examples I'm going to talk about are from the context of American politics. And I hope you can forgive me for that, because what I would like to do is try to talk about what I know something about and not try to talk about things that I know relatively little about, because that would be foolish. But I would like, maybe in Q&A or maybe just in the background of all this, to think about the extent to which what I have to say here might be applied to various forms of offensive, and again, that means offense-causing, offensive speech in other contexts. So in just thinking about this a little bit, it seemed to me that burkinis are a very interesting case, offensive as they are to certain conservative secularists. Satirical cartoons of Muhammad are an interesting case, offensive as they are to many Muslims, or the Canal, offensive as it is to many anti-racists. But I'm going to focus on these American cases because they are something I know at least enough about to say something hopefully intelligible. So take these white supremacists, these white nationalists, and their protests are offensive to many Americans. And among American progressives, there's this increasing sense that this kind of protest ought to be excluded from public discourse. So Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, said of the Charlottesville protests that you may have seen in the news, which are, I think these are all photographs of those very protests, not this one, but the top three are all photographs of those very protests. These expressions of extreme racism, he said, have no place in our discourse. And Bernie Sanders, presidential contender of 2006 and senator of Vermont, said that these kinds of expressions have, quote, no place in our society. Liberals will recoil a bit from this because they think the exclusion of ideas from the marketplace of ideas risks undermining its proper functioning. Now, you might wonder what good could possibly come from the inclusion of this in a marketplace of ideas. Well, I think in the context in which these things appear, there is a benefit of such inclusion Or there at least might be. And it derives actually not specifically from the white supremacism that is expressed in many of these protests or by many of these protesters, but rather with various ideas that are in the neighborhood of white supremacism. So it's not, so if you're familiar with Mill on this, it's not, as Mill might have said, that we're not quite sure whether white supremacism is false and we need to make sure. And it's not that it contains a portion of the truth. And it's not that we can't really reasonably reject white supremacism unless we engage with it. It would just be prejudiced against it. And it's certainly not that I think our commitment to anti-racism will be weakened unless we engage with white supremacism. Those are all what the things kind of Mill would say. I'm not sure any of those things is really plausible in this case. But I think those things are plausible when applied to certain ideas that are in the neighborhood of white supremacism. So for example, in America, it is a widespread view among white Americans that white Americans face more discrimination than Americans of color. That is a fairly common view among white Americans. And that idea, I think, really does deserve a place in our discourse and in our society. The reason is that that view needs to be articulated, it needs to be debated, critiqued, and refuted, right? There is a benefit to having that idea in the space of reasons. So when these white nationalists in Charlottesville say, "You will not replace us," as they say, I think it was that idea that was at least in the background of their racist outrage. And I think that is an idea that really does need to be vigorously and earnestly contested. So there is a benefit of inclusion here. So if there were a way that we could engage with this kind of speech, it would have, I think, the kind of benefits that the liberal is pointing us in the direction of. So what I'm not suggesting is that we do engage, however. So what I'm not suggesting is that we do engage, we progressives. I guess I'm counting myself among the progressives. I'm not sure about that. But it's not suggested here that the progressives should engage with white supremacists for the purposes of discussing this idea because of the context in which these protests occur, where there is not mutual intellectual trust between the would-be participants in the marketplace. So what I want to diagnose sort of the problem here is that at least one problem here is not with the content of this offensive speech, but with the context of intellectual distrust in which it appears. A change of this context would make it easier. I think it would require much less effort for a progressive, for example, to critically engage with these white nationalists, despite being offended by what they have to say. If there was some hope on the part of the progressive, that they might be taken seriously and that their arguments might make a difference vis-a-vis the beliefs of their interlocutors. That is the kind of benefit that would accrue from intellectual trust. I want to then briefly talk about another case of offensive speech. Here is speech that offends not the progressive, but the conservative in American politics. This is the speech of those who are critical of implicit bias and institutional racism in American police officers and police departments. And these displays are offensive to many Americans, namely those conservatives who associate themselves with the law enforcement community. Many conservatives consider these kinds of protests to be insulting and disrespectful to the law enforcement community. This is a flag that is the Blue Lives Matter flag, so it is a flag of solidarity with law enforcement, and it's being stomped upon. This is the Blue Lives Murder slogan, which is a response to Blue Lives Matter, which is itself a response to Black Lives Matter. And this is Colin Kaepernick, this all blew up over the last weekend, so maybe this is more in the news, but this is an American football star. Well, he was a bit of a star. But whose claim to fame is that he kneels during the national anthem, and he's since been effectively fired from the league. But those are also his socks, in which a police hat is on top of a pig. So this is offensive stuff to the conservatives, who are in some ways the targets of critique here. Vice presidential candidate Mike, back when he was a candidate, Mike Pence appealed explicitly to offense in connection with implicit bias and institutional racism. So what he said on the campaign trail was, quote, "What I find offensive is when people refer to implicit bias or institutional bias within the ranks of our law enforcement community broadly," and he argued that that really, quote, really has got to stop. So Pence, too, wanted to exclude a certain kind of offensive speech from a discussion. He didn't think it had any place in public discourse. He may have had, I think, Kaepernick had just begun this protest not long before he said that, so he may have had Kaepernick in mind. Liberals, again, are going to recoil at this and say there's a benefit to having this kind of offensive speech in the marketplace of ideas. These ideas should not be excluded, despite the fact that they offend many people. The idea that police officers suffer from implicit bias and the idea that there's institutional racism, those ideas deserve to be vigorously and earnestly contested in the marketplace of ideas. So there's a benefit if we could get people to engage with these offensive displays. But again, I don't want to suggest that the conservatives who are offended by these displays should go ahead and attempt to engage with the critics of police racism, because that kind of engagement can't be productive unless there's a context of mutual intellectual trust in the background. And in many cases, such does not exist. So that's really all I have to say. So let me sum that up. Liberals say the function of a marketplace of ideas is to create an incentive for people to articulate and defend plausible ideas. The proper functioning of a marketplace of ideas requires mutual intellectual trust among its participants. And I think the presence of intellectual mutual intellectual trust can, at least in some ways, mitigate at least one of the harms of offensive speech, which provides liberals with a kind of resource for dealing with the problem of offensive speech. And it's a rather different resource than the move to a limited censorship. So I think it opens up a different kind of avenue of approaching offensive speech than we've seen so far. Thanks.